Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we talk making money, saving money, and getting out of debt, all while having some fun along the way.
Yeah, I think this is going to be another good episode in a string of episodes as far as comedic value goes. LOL. And as a reminder, once again, we've entered the FedEx Small Business Grant Contest, where we have the potential to win up to 50 G's. I guess I should spell that out because the internet thinks a stacks a month is like $26,000 a year. So that is $50,000 with three zeros. Four, if you're being technical. And to invest specifically in the PNB brand, you can support us with three easy choices. You may vote today. You can vote every 24 hours all through the month of March. You can click the share this business on social media or post the voting badge. We've made it very simple. Go to paybal.co/FedEx. Again, that's paybal.co/FedEx. And just like the company, it is case sensitive. So FedEx is capital F, capital E.
Yes, definitely encourage people to vote. I think as we said in the past couple of episodes, it's one of the most important ways to support the podcast, because imagine what we could do if we had the resources, considering that we're both juggling full-time day gigs currently. And so who are we talking to on today's show, good brother?
We are talking to the one, the only, Gabby Dunn. I met Gabby in New York City at J.P. Morgan Chase National Savings Month. Shout out to Kiasha for making that possible. And the Making Money Moves panel. You can find a link in the show notes, of course. But Gabby is the author of Bad With Money, a best-selling author, journalist, television writer, actress, and LGBTQ activist living in Los Angeles. Her podcast of the same name, Bad With Money, in case you somehow forgot over the last 2 seconds, was named one of the top 10 podcasts of 2016 by the New York Times. She believes in speaking honestly, openly, and candidly about money, and she did the same on another fun and informative episode where she adds another key to the smooth sounds of PNB. We know you'll enjoy. And welcome to the show, Gabby.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, of course, I want to spend the bulk of the discussion talking about the book and stories and your awesome Bad With Money book. So first off, what inspired you to write this? And I was a little bit surprised, this money book autobiography, if you will.
Yeah, financial memoir is a new thing, I guess. Ah. I had a podcast called Bad With Money, and I just like always had money problems, and I never talked to anyone about them, and I never knew like who to even ask or what to even ask. And I figured that a lot of people were just like me, but didn't, I mean, they just didn't have the opportunity to make a podcast about it. And so I thought, you know, I'll do this show. And even, you know, cause if something's sort of taboo to talk about, I'll run through a gamut of like, okay, is my family going to disown me? No. If I talk about it, like, am I going to lose my job? No. And like, is it going to harm me in any way? Not really. So I was like, okay, if I have the privilege of talking about this stuff, then I should probably do it. And so the podcast was on season 3, and I got the opportunity to write a book based on the podcast. And then I was like, well, I want to dig deeper in the book and get to like the root of why I'm like this and, you know, the things that I've learned in the last year. But I still don't know everything. And I think that's kind of the crux of the book, is like, this stuff is crazy. Like, it's, I had to make it my full-time job in order to barely understand it. And that's wild.
Yeah. So what was your experience with money growing up?
I mean, I just never knew anything about it. My parents they're very like experience-based people, and they didn't want us to not have these experiences at the risk of, you know, like missing out on anything. And so they wanted us to go on trips, and they wanted us to be able to go to the summer camps that we wanted to go to and things like that. But they just never really thought ahead, and they still don't. And I, you know, I'll still get like little gifts from my mom in the mail, which is very nice, but I'll be like, I don't need like a 45th necklace. Like, I don't know what's going on. Like, I think it's kind of, they have like a compulsion. And then it was never explained to me. So I was sort of parentalized pretty young. Like, my dad was an alcoholic and an addict. So I would go, well, guys, I think like last week you said that we couldn't afford this. And then this week we're buying this other thing. So maybe we shouldn't. And they would just kind of be like, okay, you're nosy, stay out of it, which I talked to some high school kids in Chicago, and they were saying a similar thing where their parents like will want them to be an adult when it's time to watch their siblings. But then if they ask a question about money, they're like acting grown. And so it was sort of like this whiplash, I say in the book, of like, okay, so we can do this versus like all of a sudden it's feast or famine, basically.
I really appreciate you saying or sharing the story about your experience and your parents. And so how did the way that you saw money growing up and the way that your parents interacted and that impact on you, how did that impact the way you thought about money in relationships? Or is that something that you have not thought about so much in relationships?
Well, my mom was the breadwinner and the more stable person. And so I always kind of had this idea of like the woman taking care of the situation. And also sort of this idea of like, if there's a problem, just throw money at it. But even if it's money you don't have, I'm a queer woman. So, my girlfriend and I, it's a little bit less of like the standard gender roles where she and I have a bit of leeway to be like, okay, what do we want this to look like? And I kind of almost too soon in relationships try to figure out if their family has money, especially because in Los Angeles, she works in fashion, but everyone is sort of in show business. And so it's like, if someone is a freelance editor, are they actually a freelance editor making freelance editor money, or do their parents have money and give them money? And that's like a different thing. Like there's a sort of stress that comes with, for example, me not being able to take money from my parents versus like other friends in my situation, working in entertainment or working in podcasting or in TV who have a bit of a fallback that I don't have. So I think I am slightly more aware that I can't really compare myself to other people, although I still do. But it just, so when I started in New York, I would always be like, why can this person do all this stuff and make a short film? And why do they work the same job as me, but they're not as stressed out? Like, why is this the case? And I would think that it was because I wasn't talented or because I wasn't working hard enough, when it took me so long. I think I was like 25 when I was like, wait a minute, people's parents help them. And so, and like, if your parents do help you, please take all their money, take it and run. But yeah, I just never thought about it. And so I never looked into it, and I never saw what was in my bank account. I never thought about it until it was dire, and then something would come through to fix it. And then I would go, great.
Got it. And so some folks, they hear LA, New York, writing. So can you share a little bit about your background and how you even got into this space?
Yeah, I mean, I was a journalist. In high school, I worked as a reporter at a local newspaper as like a job, among other things, like being a cater waiter and stuff. But I worked as a reporter, and then I went to school for journalism. And I just always wanted to be a writer, but I kind of had in the back of my mind that if I was like a novelist, I wasn't sure what your job was day to day. But if I was a reporter, then I was like, okay, you go into a job, I'm pretty sure. And so I was like aware of that. And so I went to college for journalism. And then I was always freelancing and then getting like these day jobs at magazines. And then, and it was really hard. I mean, after college, you know, I majored in print journalism, which isn't a thing. So I would, I would get all these digital jobs or I wouldn't, you know, get a job at all. I was applying to tons of newspapers and it just like wasn't happening because they were firing more than hiring. So my plan for what would be stable actually ended up being like majoring in the Titanic and, right. Best laid plans. And I had done comedy in college as like a hobby. And so I was doing stand up, but that's like a money suck. And I was also working at different newspapers, or I would lie and say, oh yeah, I know how to make flash animations, or, oh yeah, I mean, I lied my way into so many jobs that would last like 2 months. And then I would be like, I got to get out of here before these people realize I can't do this. And so that, like, it was just like super high stress levels, and I was crying all the time. And then I moved out to LA primarily with the idea that it would be cheaper. Like I saw apartments where I was like, okay, I can get more for more space for less money. So like in New York, I paid I think, like $1,000 to basically live in a closet. Yeah. And then in LA, $1,000 would get me like a studio. So I was like, all right, well, a closet in someone else's apartment versus like I could live alone in a studio. So I moved and I had some more work opportunities out here. And then it's been like shifted towards more entertainment stuff. Although my dad says that bad with money is journalism. I think at an attempt to say that I'm using my degree. But it is. Like I researched and it is journalism. But I do more, I write for TV, although I haven't chosen the stablest stuff. Like that's a job that ends after 3 months and then you don't have a job. Or, you know, you sell a TV show or something and then you wait and then you don't do anything. Or you write other stuff. It's lucky that I like writing. So I try to create other things and I always am trying to create something that could be IP for the future. So like if I make something, I want it to be a book next or I want it adapted or I want it like I always with Bad With Money with the podcast, I was like, okay, this could turn into a book. This could turn into a TV show. Like, let's try to think. I'm trying to keep myself working for the next like 5 years, basically. But it is like every time something happens, I go, well, this is the end of my career versus like if I had a day job.
And I also want to, I think it was an extension of a compliment from your father there and that you are using your degree. Cause I think that's parents' role is to lecture you until you're apparently there or your grave. So
yeah, exactly.
That's a lost art, but I really did. So I'm an auditor by day. So I actually like facts and figures. So I saw a bibliography.
Oh,
I was like, I haven't seen this in forever. I was like really amazed and impressed. But
bibliography.
Exactly.
I'm scared of anyone. Like I had a fact checker. I hired my own fact checker to make sure that everything was accurate. Like I was like sweating accuracy so hard.
And that's what I think there's there'll probably be another one by the time this podcast comes out. But I think a lady literally got dragged this week because she plagiarized like half of her key points in her book. And then she's trying to defend that the rest of the points are still valid, even though she plagiarized these parts. It's like it invalidates the entire book. But like facts are a lost art. We literally live in this generation. And I think it's a little bit strange where it's just widely accepted. Like there's entire social media accounts where they blatantly plagiarize and they have to take a screenshot. This fascinates me.
Yeah.
They remove the @ and then they post it on their account. I'm like, you've already got it right there. Why don't you just paste the whole thing?
Yeah, I know. And I was surprised in the publishing world that there's not really a fact checker. Like there's like people that go through and make sure you don't get sued, but there wasn't anyone that's job was to specifically make sure that the quotes were correct. Or like I had a girl go through and listen back to my interviews and make sure that the quotes were right. And like I was surprised that the publisher seemed uninterested in doing that.
I'd slow clap, but it would mess up the feed. But yeah, that is both amazing to me and sad to me. And I'm glad that you went through that extra effort. So in doing that, is there any one particular either interview or research or multiple ones that just shocked you, like just really jumped out?
Well, the disability stuff is wild to me that disabled people are not allowed to save more than $2,000 total before their benefits are cut, which I'm not sure what the it's this thing of like not wanting to. I understand the idea of like, okay, well, if you're working enough to have this money, then you don't need benefits. But it's like, how are they supposed to get out of the hole then? It doesn't make any sense in terms of economic mobility, which I think a lot of stuff doesn't, because it's sort of on purpose meant to be like, no, we keep you at this level and we keep you at this level and that's it. So like the lack of economic mobility really shocked me that people can't afford like if you're working full time, most people can't afford like a 2-bedroom apartment, or that most people can't put together like $400, I think it was, in case of an emergency. Like that's so wild that people work day jobs. And then, you know, the whole side hustle economy that you work a day job and then productivity culture says you should work a night job too. And everyone is like applauded for that instead of being like, well, why is this the way that the world is set up? Why is this how America works? It used to be that you had your job and then you were relatively okay. Someone tweeted, and I posted it on my Instagram, that the most shocking part of the Ted Bundy documentary was that the people they interviewed would be like, witnesses would be like, yeah, it was 1974. I had a part-time job at the gas station and I bought myself a new Camaro. And like just these sentences that now would be insane.
Right. I thought you were going to say bought Newports, but go on.
No, but like you had a part-time job at the gas station in 1974 and you could buy a car.
Man, I can't imagine.
Right. It's just kind of set up in this way that if you're able to get out of your class, you're exceptional versus like if you, it should be a thing that we all are striving towards, but then it goes, well, you know, that's the American dream is to try to, you know, it's like this unattainable thing basically, but we sell it as like, no, that's the American dream. Everyone can do it.
And you talk a little bit about that, and I think you have right here, as far as you talk about the millennial myth in the specific chapter from the book, but it's also the myth that millennials are all upper class, and that's kind of how they're talked about in the press. Can you kind of explain that a little bit and what you've seen from both sides?
My friend and reporter, Nona Aronowitz, writes really amazingly about millennials in poverty, and she talks about how the ways the media portrays millennials is like, I'm taking a selfie while eating avocado toast and I'm largely white and I work at a startup and I'm an, upper middle class millennial versus like the statistics showing that millennials are largely working in the service and retail industry. And, I'd say in the book that like millennials, so the minimum wage is then a millennial issue, or like most of the young people killed by police are millennials, but we never think of police brutality as a millennial issue. So we only really focus on student loans as a millennial issue, but that is sort of a quote unquote privilege to have them. And so she was like, you know, poor people are viewed as poor and they're always poor no matter what their age is. And we lump them in poor. And then our generation, quote unquote, is like, only seen as these upper and middle class people. And that has a trickle down policy for a trickle down effect to policy where then we only say, oh, millennials are only interested in student loan forgiveness when like that's not entirely true. And so, I mean, it's like this thing of like, oh, well, they're lazy and entitled. But if you went to East Texas and looked at a Latinx mother of two who works like three jobs, who's 25, you would never say, oh, that's a lazy millennial.
I mean, just for context, because we have people on both sides, although it's a latter or senior millennial leaning audience. So it's 18 to 34. And you really brought out in the book, and I think you're bringing out here, is even in the headlines, when the subject matter is, like you said, either police brutality or poor or any topic other than school loans and credit card debt, the generation isn't described. So it's right. Like poor person, struggles or right. This person shot. They're just this abstract individual. But if they're 18 to 34, it's almost like the millennial trope then comes on when it's a popular stereotype to get clicks.
Exactly.
There was that popular article, and I'm at this point where I think they do some of this on purpose, and
of course.
You've probably seen this where they dropped the graphic and they literally didn't cover Gen X, like Gen X didn't exist.
Yep.
They had literally cut out, it's just going to sound bad. I'm probably going to get some write-ins for this. I don't know what Gen X is, but I also know they exist. I at least know they're alive. Like it
made
it seem.
Have you seen Reality Bites? That's all it is.
Oh, no. What's that?
Reality Bites is a movie with Winona Ryder, and it's pretty much just, it's that. That's Gen X. Some people will be like, okay, but that's why I've seen that, and I'm pretty sure I've got it.
So my millennial references Can't Hardly Wait, which is actually a movie that I ashamedly love, which is why I'm stuttering right now. And it was like my perspective of what college was going to be like. And I, what was that, mm-hmm. Jennifer Love Hewitt or whatever? And
oh,
I
yeah.
was like, that's going to be the party. And then I'm going to go to college and everything's going to be awesome. It wasn't bad, but it didn't quite turn out like Can't Hardly Wait, which is a great movie that everybody should watch. I'm sure it's on Netflix. But one of the millennial tropes that actually I do want to talk about, because you talk about the other side of it, is that followers don't necessarily translate into money. And so honestly, this is strange because I don't have a lot, but this happens to me because like now I'm over 1,000. So people are like, you're rich. Like how much are these followers paying you? And I'm like, I can't pay my bills and followers.
I know. I often look at my Instagram following and go, if every one of those people gave me a dollar, that would solve all my problems.
Yeah. Sometimes I think about soliciting it too. And the funny thing is, to that point, is, you know, you have 300,000. But I think I was looking at somebody else's profile.
No, so, that's about right.
Okay. So I'll be like, hey guys, click this link, and like nothing. No clicks, yeah. No conversion. And then I'm like, hey, look at this cat video, 5,000 retweets. I'm like, really, yep, guys? Really? Yep, that's what we're doing out here in the streets.
That is what they're doing. I think like people had a really skewed idea of what internet fame, quote unquote, was about. Like I had people tell me, I asked fans, like, what do you think I make money from? And they were like, well, YouTube pays you a salary. And I was like, you think that I work, like, because I make YouTube videos, I work for YouTube? What? Like, they literally thought that I was like a employee of YouTube. So I was like, no, guys, like, absolutely not. Like, ad money is peanuts. And like, that's, you know, the boom of YouTubers getting to be millionaires is sort of over. I was surprised. They just thought if they see you a lot on things, then you must be wealthy. But even when I worked for BuzzFeed, my salary wasn't large, and they knew that they could just put my face everywhere on the internet and pay me like a regular person's salary. So it's like very strange. And I think also then people buy into that and they try to look wealthy on their social because people think that they're wealthy. And I kind of have like, I worry about the people that follow me because they're very young. So I try to, like, if someone, like someone just commented and was like, oh, your skin is so perfect. And I was like, no, this picture is from a shoot where I had professional makeup. Or like if someone's like, oh, like I wore a dress to a wedding, and they were like, oh my God, that's an amazing dress. And it was Marquesa. And I was like, it's Rent the Runway. Like, I'm trying very hard to be like, guys, this is not real. But it also is like, you know, you want to seem like, I get upset because I'm like, I want to seem like I'm balling, but I'm not.
First of all, I appreciate you for even being conscious enough to do that. I was watching The Breakfast Club, and they had Kodak Black on there, who's actually, if you haven't had an opportunity to watch one of his interviews, however you may feel about him, he's problematic, I'll give you that. But his interviews are always hilarious. And they were like, I see you out there with all the chains and the whips and the cars and everything like that. He's like, I'm broke. Yeah. And he's like, all those chains and cars are rented. Like, you know, I owe Sony $1 million. And it's just really the other side of the story that people don't talk about are here. One such one you talk about is you had a waitress friend, or actually a social media rich friend, who was working as a waitress. And you said that she couldn't continue to work as a waitress because she became too recognizable, which is crazy because now her literal income is impacted because people are like, no, shouldn't you be out there balling because you're social media rich?
Yeah. And that was because BuzzFeed hired her part time and then knew that they could use her face and refused to hire her full time. And it was like actually evil. But there was like a bunch of friends who are just YouTubers on their own. And the one girl I write about, she was working at Starbucks, and fans started memorizing her schedule and then coming in. Oh, wow. And then her boss was rightfully annoyed. So like, it's this thing where you try to make a living, but then, you know, your boss will be like, well, why are you getting distracted at work? We don't want to have this person who's going to cause a fuss or whatever. Even though maybe those people should have just bought drinks and then the boss wouldn't have cared. But I mean, I drove Postmates for a while, and I had there's this documentary that I was in. Oh, I can't remember. Oh, it's called Vlogumentary. But I was in it, and it was like they followed me on doing Postmates, and they caught, lucky for them, but they caught like me trying to get a Postmate order from Chipotle, and the guy behind the counter being like, aren't you a YouTuber? And like asking me like, what are you doing? And I was like, guys. So like, it was, and it's in the documentary, which is horrifying. But yeah, I mean, it's just like your options for day jobs then become a bit limited, unless I guess you try to work at one of the big media companies. But even then, that's not like a huge salary. And also then it's catch 22, because then they own your IP. So a lot of the stuff that I was creating, when I worked for BuzzFeed, I didn't, when I was, when I left or was sort of forced out, I didn't keep any of that. So it's not like I could, so then I had to start from zero basically. So it's this catch 22 of like, you know, all the people that got fired from BuzzFeed recently, they don't get to take any of that stuff with them. So if they wanted to write a book, like I started my last months there, I got so paranoid about getting fired that I would bring my own laptop in and then I would write stuff on my laptop so that they couldn't later claim that I had used their property to make something so they could own it. And that, and like I start even like tweeting, I would never tweet from one of their computers because I was like, they could say they own my Twitter account. Like I started getting really nervous, but then it was rightfully so because we left. And then, you know, recently all those people were fired, you know, randomly and like in huge chunks. And so that's the risk you run working for one of those big companies, even though the income is more stable. So it's like, basically you can't win and everything is bad. Next question.
Well, I can't say I disagree. Now, mind you, I'm quite literally on the outside looking in and you're on the inside looking out. But yeah, there was somebody who still works at BuzzFeed. I won't drop her name. I'm assuming that she's still employed there. But she did tweet it and she said that not only did they, here's why I think it's unfair. Not only did they fire all those individuals, they then that same day or same week that they were firing, they posted a position for fellows, which sounds like a glamorized intern's position.
Internship.
For unpaid positions up to 12 months in New York City. And I'm like, okay, that's where I got to draw the line. Like it, I mean, it's one thing. Okay. I guess I, what's my choice. I respect the corporate and, you know, consumerism that is America. Cool. I live here too. I live within these borders as well. But at the point where you're like, okay, we're going to just lay off all of these heads and then hire back free labor. I'm like, all right, time out.
Yeah.
Like that's not what the game is. You're changing the rules.
Yes. Well, I have a whole chapter in the book about unpaid internships and how one really put me into a lot of debt. But I was working for Viacom for The Daily Show. And I was like, you know, I say it was like 2008. So that it was like Obama had just been elected and The Daily Show like was like the core of everything. And there were no like really not podcasts or anything like that. So if you wanted like fun political news, like that was the only place you could go. And he was like a rock star, you know? And so I was like, oh my God, I have to work here. This will be amazing for my career, even as a journalist. Cause I was like, this is journalism. This is the, and then, you know, this self-righteous thing of like, this is the most honest journalism there is right now, whatever. And so coming off of George Bush, what a dream. Anyway. And so then we were like, so I was like, I have to work here. And I was also like obsessed with the show. And then, but it was a free unpaid internship. And I ended up needing college credit. So then I had to pay my school to let me do the internship basically, which is bananas. And then I talked to other people who had a similar situation where like they're required to do an internship by their school for credit, but then the internship is like a full-time job and they're not getting paid. And so there's a lot of people pushing back on that where they're like, this is illegal, or they sue, you know, these class action lawsuits. And Viacom was sued and had to change the way that they pay interns. But I mean, it's just like, so, they say it's legal, but unethical basically.
Hey folks, we're taking a quick break to tell you about today's sponsor. If you've been thinking about re-upping in the classroom, you should check out the University of California Irvine's continuing education programs. UCI has over 60 convenient certificates and specialized study programs that can help you take your career or business to the next level. Whether you're thinking about starting your own thing, finding a job that doesn't make you want to fight the air, or climbing the ladder in your current gig, UCI's continuing education programs can help you get there. You'll have access to instructors with industry experience and the opportunity to interact with your classmates, which comes in handy when you're trying to understand what's happening in the real world. UCI's spring quarter is upon us and registration is open. Visit ce.uci.edu/podcast and enter promo code podcast for 15% off one course. Again, visit ce.uci.edu/podcast and enter promo code podcast for 15% off one course. And if you couldn't write that down, be sure to check out the show notes. And now, back to the show.
it's probably a very small amount of people given our audience, but for the other listening audience, I'm going to go ahead and fact check here, is you also point out that 1 in 3 students who do an unpaid internship reported that it led to a job offer. So only 1 in 3, and that's only 2% higher than students who do an internship. So people who are like, you know, you got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I just want to note it. I want to point out that only 2% of those bootstrap pullers were improved by this internship. So it doesn't automatically lead to the job, like assuming it ever right. did. There's a lot of fallacies out there like that I think are being exposed that, okay, this always worked. And then you look at the data and it like, actually it never worked. It's just now we have access to the information.
No, because they got your work for free and then they let you go and then they hire another free person. And the other thing that I talk about is that it really limits diversity because, you know, the only people that can afford to intern are people that have some sort of fallback or they're going into debt like me, but that have some sort of like way to afford to live in these cities or to live with no income, basically. And so it limits the pool. I mean, the studies have shown this. It limits the pool to like upper-class white applicants. And then so I talked to this company that does pay interns, and they're like one of the companies in that's pays interns really well, and they're on Glassdoor and everything, which is like a transparency site for intern payments and also for salary transparency. And the woman there said, the head of like diversity HR said, well, we get better applicants that way. Like we get better people because it's coming from a wider pool and people will work harder when you're paying them.
I always think, I appreciate you pointing that out. I always think it's insane when people come to the conclusion. Now, mind you, I came to that conclusion in college when I was like, studying helps my grades. But when people, people are like, when you pay people, they work harder than people that are not paid. Like these like common sense, you know, sense ain't common, conclusions. it's just, yeah.
Pay
people
of course.
Well, they work better for you. And then there's also, and I think you talked about this in your book as well, there are several studies that also provide that when you have that security of a job that actually can provide for your living, you are a better worker as an employee because you don't have to be stressed out about how you're going to keep a roof over your head.
Exactly. Yeah. And you have more time to, you know, not that like whatever, but you have more time to devote to the job because, you're getting paid or, you know, you can apply for overtime or whatever, because like, then it's for me, at least I was like, well, I got to get out of here. Like I'm here 9 to 5 and that's it. Cause they're not paying me. I don't know. This woman was just saying that it's like, it's more, the spirits of her employees are higher and then it leads to better work.
So I've always found the digital space really weird because there's this whole, you know, you got to get bylines and so on. Uh-huh. And I've noticed this tension of, I'm just getting started. And there are all these websites out here where they say, send us pitches and we'll run you, HuffPost, whatever it is. So what are your thoughts on this whole, if you're just getting started, that you need to write free content to get the street cred or receipts versus when you're just getting started, you need to be asking for money with every article that you write or every piece of content that you're producing for another company?
Well, I did a thing that I'm just now wondering maybe was a workaround where I had my own blog and I put ads on it. And so I had this blog that I was writing called 100 Interviews that I did for a year. And I would just interview interesting people. And I had ads on it. And so that blog started getting popular. And that was sort of the thing that launched me. But so that blog was getting popular. And I was making like a tiny bit of money from it, like no money, but no money better than actually no money. So I was writing for websites, for other websites for free, and then kind of linking people back to the other website that was like my own website. So I guess it would make sense to do if you had something to, like at the bottom, you know, like Gabby Dunn is the author of blah, blah, blah. If you had something to link back to that actually made you money, or if you had like a YouTube channel to link back to that could give you AdSense or something, just like, I don't know, some benefit for you other than exposure, because exposure isn't going to pay your rent. But I don't know, I did write for free. I wrote for a place for free that they had a thing where they were like, you can write here for free. for, you know, 5 articles. And then if the articles do really well, then you can, we'll start to pay you. Which this was like 2012. So there was no like, you know, there's websites called Who Pays Writers or Who Pays Interns, that you can look at. And so there was no like transparency. So I was like, I guess this is the way to do it. But now I think you can go on those websites and actually find places that will pay you. And it's always more money, like digitally. Like I would write these articles for like $50 online versus like I would write something for a magazine that would be like $500. It's harder to pitch things to magazines, but I would wonder, like breaking it down time-wise, if it's worth it to do more pitches for those kind of things in your day-to-day versus waiting. It's almost like you could take a part in a B movie and you would get some money for that and you're working, or you, I guess, like wait and then try to get into an Oscars movie. Does that make sense?
Right.
I want to say now, don't work for free, or if you do work for free, do it on your own thing. So like make your own Instagram or make your own blog, I guess. So you're not giving it away to a company, although the company might have like more, you know, more followers, but then I guess do that very sparingly and then try to link back to your actual thing.
Yeah. So in this space, you know, first of all, let me disclose with, you know, hate the game, not the player. So I'm not hating on anybody like this. I don't knock anybody that can find fools who want to part with their money. Like, hey, got more power to you. But I know a lot of people do these income reports. And, you know, because I'm an auditor and no one else looks at facts, I go in and look at the numbers.
Of course you do.
And so consistently, I ain't gonna call nobody out by name, but you'll see somebody like, hey, I made $20,000 this month. And I get that. That's how you get that's the clickbait. I get that. You got to get people in. We name articles just like that. Don't get me wrong. But yeah. Then you go and read the numbers and it's like, I made $500 this month. Buy my course for $1,000 to learn how to make $500. And then 20 people buy the course. I'm like, you taught 20 fools to pay $1,000 to learn how to make $500. And then next month they make 30, and next month they make 40, but they never make more than $500. I mean, over time, their traffic grows so large, they just convert an audience. But I've noticed a lot of time the gimmick is I made, you know, my first, you know, whatever it is, $500, $100, buy this $1,000 course. And really the course is teaching not how to make $20,000, it's teaching you how to make $500. And I'm like, is no one else seeing this? And I guess not, because the numbers keep growing and growing and growing. And then it's like, it's that ultimate question, like, what does Kim Kardashian do? It becomes a point where the audience is so large, it's like it's self-fulfilling machine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do ads, and but like they're very few and far between. And it's actually like we're turning the YouTube channel now into a podcast, because podcasting has more ads, and it's just more like we're getting so many more brand deals for the podcast than we are for the YouTube channel. And I think we're just trying to follow where the money is going. And because like it wasn't like that before, but now it's like we decided, you know, that a podcast is more profitable. So that's what we're moving towards.
I personally appreciate, I'm writing that down, follow where the money is going. Because I was like, we've gone back and forth about if we need to get on YouTube and start a YouTube channel. But I'm like, hey, if the podcast is where it's at, I just keep on doing what I'm doing. So
you
I feel
record,
like...
you could record yourselves doing the podcast and then put it on YouTube. Then you kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah, people been telling us. They've been telling us.
But it's like... you just have to weigh if it's worth it. I don't know. It's always silly. Like some people, you know, we have our YouTube channel and some people will be like, I listen to this in my car. I don't even look at it. And we were like, okay, well, that's a podcast. So I guess we should do that.
So I this has been good to me. I've been laughing. I got a smile on my face. But just in case it came across as doom and gloom. Now, I can't gauge by myself because I'm like on the borderline of realist and pessimist. So even bad news is happy to me. So just in case, you know, some people are like, I want to hear some good stuff.
Sure.
You tell a story about actually randomly soliciting a Hollywood script. And a lot of course, millennials and trolls are like, nah, that doesn't work. And it did. So can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, I had the blog that was popular and I knew that, and I didn't know anything about show business, which I still call it show business and people make fun of me, but I think that's funny. But so I knew that people were reading it. I knew I had like, you know, 25,000 people reading it. So I was like, one of those people must be successful in some way. So I made a post just statistically. So I made a post that was like, hey guys, this isn't the regular content, but I was just wondering if anyone on here works in entertainment and would be interested in reading a script that I wrote for a pilot. And I had never written a pilot before. And out of, 25,000 people or whatever, two people worked in entertainment. One worked at Nickelodeon and one worked at Gersh, a talent agency. And they both reached out and were like, hey, we like your blog. Can we read your script? And I was like, sure. And so I sent it to them. And the guy from Gersh ended up being my first agent. And the guy from Nickelodeon a couple years later hired me on a sketch show. But then I also had friends of mine who read the blog come to me and be like, what you did was so embarrassing. Like, you really have to take that down. Like, it's really embarrassing. Like, it looks like you're desperate. It looks like you're begging or whatever. Like, this is like really not how it works in show business. Like, this is like, you're going to regret this because you're young. Like, this is like weird. And even when I started the YouTube channel, friends of mine were like, in comedy, were like sneering at it because it wasn't like stand up. It wasn't, this typical path or whatever. So they were like, this is really embarrassing for you. And like, you should stop. And I was like, I don't think it's embarrassing. And also, it's sort of this thing of like, you're not going to get what you don't ask for. So like, I had to, and also you have to already, I say this in the book, maybe I forget, but I always say, you always have to be doing what you should be doing already what you want to do so people can see you doing it and then pay you. So like, it wouldn't have done me any good to be like, I want to write scripts and never write one and then never tell anyone that I wrote one and just wait for someone to come to me and go, hey, have you ever written a script? And then for me to go, why, yes, I have. You have to show that you're already doing it. Like even with the blog, I wanted to be hired as a reporter. So I did the blog where I was interviewing people so that people would go, oh, you're an interview person. Like, or if they're at their job and they're like, look, they're like, we should hire someone to do interviews. Oh, you know who does interviews? This girl I know who has a blog. Just like, because nobody's going to know what you're doing if you're just doing it secretly.
And so you've mentioned comedy and doing stand-up. And I remember it was probably about a year ago where I was thinking, should I do an improv class? Because that'll help with public speaking. And so... Mm-hmm. One, how did you get into comedy? And then two, how has that helped you with some of the other things that you're involved in?
Well, I liked journalism and I liked politics and reporting. And so I would watch, like I said, I would watch The Daily Show all the time. And I was like, I think people get information easier if it's funny. So I always, I was a reporter, but I always tried to make the lead, which is like the beginning of the article, like interesting or kind of funny, or I would try to like use puns or something in the headline or whatever. And so I just thought that it was useful to conveying information to be funny. And then with Bad with Money, it's like a, it's a finance show, but I'm sort of goofy on it. And I'm really like, I say a lot of dumb stuff. And so I think like, me being funny sort of breaks the tension of people listening who are like very anxious. And so I don't think it hurts to try to learn how to think on your feet or learn how to, or, incorporate humor into stuff. I didn't think it was going to harm me in whatever, even if I was just like the funniest person in the IT department, I didn't think it was going to harm me, you know?
Wearing a Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah. Wearing a Hawaiian shirt, being the fun guy in the office. Sure. And so I didn't think it was a bad thing. Now, I also was very skeptical of ever making money from it, which is why I did the journalism degree. But I was on a sketch troupe, and it was also a thing of like, I wanted people to know that I was interested in entertainment. Otherwise, I don't know. It's like weird to think about what you post. Like, I see people who are posting like a script that they're working on or being like, oh, I'm in my improv class. And I'm like, yeah, that's sort of like, I get that people go, oh, that's tacky or whatever. But also like, how do you know someone isn't going to go, oh, this person does improv? Like, that's so cool. He should come in and talk to my class or whatever for a fee. Or, oh, she's writing a script. I wonder what it's about. I should reach out or whatever. Like, I think you can use social media that way, even if people find it annoying.
I mean, I want to say a couple of things here, and it's proven true in my own life, and you know, in particular to the show, but just you know, grandiose level at life in general, is never underestimate. And I think you're speaking to this, the power of networking and a genuine connection. I mean, honestly, that's how we met. We were, yeah. You know, in New York, and I Kiasha, who was doing the panel at JP Morgan Chase, I knew her from high school. And it's just where these coincidental opportunities coincide and align. You can't predict something like that. But one thing that I've come to appreciate, and I was trying to get this tweet in front of me, of course, and I, of course, can't find, oh, there it is, as Tanya from MyFab Finance, so shout out to her. She asked the question, and she, you know, she's always engaging with her audience. How many of you are doing something with your life you were previously told you couldn't?
Right.
And I have two scenarios in that. One's the books. I won't run through that because the audience heard it 1,000 times. But number two is more recently, I don't know if this has come with age, maturity, or confidence, is I don't have to justify my position to other people. So you're talking about YouTube. You're talking about BuzzFeed before that. I think a lot of times people, when they don't recognize what it is or they don't understand it, they're like, okay, that can't be done. And I'm like, that.
Right. Or they're jealous. They're jealous because they want to be able to do that. And so they want to be able to do that. And so if they see you doing it, they kind of are like, well, now it seems possible. So now me not doing it is my own fault versus like this thing of like, oh, well, it's tacky or, oh, it's not a thing you can do.
Yeah. And another thing that I've not only tried and seen come to fruition, a lot of these people don't, well, there's new trolls now, but the old trolls don't say anything because I've proven them wrong. Like I just sit there and I would think to myself, like, how does, even if I am wasting my time, how does me wasting my time impact you one way or the other? If I go out and make this YouTube, I go out and make this podcast, yeah. I go out and get on Instagram and it completely flops. How does that shake or, you know, move your foundation one way or the other?
Well, a lot of those.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I watch Shark Tank a lot. And on Shark Tank, sometimes they'll have someone come in and like, they're really good at business, but the sharks are just like, this isn't the product. Or like, they'll be like, well, we like your whole thing, but like you should expand or whatever. And I always think like, right, like, because they're nervous about this one business failing, which I totally get. But also you kind of like learn, I don't know, it's not it, but they, I always think, well, but you started it. Like you actually did it. You started it. You got to Shark Tank. Like, you know what I mean? Like you're actually ahead of the people who are just like, I could have a business. I'm watching this and I could have a business. It's like, could you?
Yeah, exactly. I have a very simple quote. I repeat it all the time because another thing that we preach and practice on the show is mentorship, but it's very simple. If you could, you would. So
right.
All those people out there sitting on the side, like, I could do that and I can do this. And I'm like, then do it. Like, if
right.
you could do it better than me, you could do it faster than me. I, you know, step up to the plate, knock it out the park. And guess what? I'll be in the stands clapping.
Right.
You know
when,
what?
When I started the Bad With Money podcast, I got a lot of emails primarily from men who were like, oh, you're bad with money. I would do this. If I were you, I would do this. And I was like, right. So then, and I would be a billionaire. And I'm like, okay, so then you do it then.
Wait, did you ask them for their opinion?
No, of course not. Absolutely not.
I had a guy write me on Twitter, which is always a fun experience, I might add. And I just use his first name. It's funny because his name is Bob, and I always think of Office Space, the Bobs, incompetent. So Bob wrote me with some bad advice, a cold take he thought was a hot take with some bad advice. And then he ended with, and I'm in finance. And I was like, so I of course, trolled the hell out of him because I had nothing to do that particular day. So I'm like, Bob in finance. And then I just proved every fact that he thinks was wrong. I think he blocked me at the end. Which, and to me, Twitter, that's a success. When like a troll trolls you and then you out troll them and they block you, it's like, I'll take that victory.
Oh my God. That's the
best thank you can get on Twitter is getting blocked by somebody who tried to prove you wrong.
Well, that's the problem of talking about money is that if you start talking about money, then everyone is suddenly an armchair expert and they want to tell you what you're doing wrong. And so the instinct is to avoid that embarrassment or that shame and go, well, it's fine. I'll never talk about it. And then I'll never have to deal with people being like, oh, you stupid idiot. Here's what you should have done when their lives aren't great either.
Yeah, I mean, my simple thing, going back to the if you could, you would, is like Bob the finance professional. I mean, that sounded so sound that you must be rich. Like your net worth must be in the millions. Your 401k is fully funded. And then I think he faded to black. Like if you got all this great advice and insight, if you could, you would. And then I have one quote from the other podcast that I do listen to, because actually I'm notoriously bad for listening to podcasts, but it's Bodega Boys, who have blown up over the years. So it's interesting seeing their journey. But I am the art, damn it. Like, I don't need your profession. Like, I am the brand. Like, and you don't have to get it. If you're not paying my bills and taxes, you know, not to brag, we just made, I looked it up, $4.38 in Amazon affiliate income. So we balling, baby. You can't talk. Don't talk down to us no more. So this was, and I knew it would be a wonderful conversation, but unfortunately, as excited as I am and got 15 questions left, I'm going to turn it over to you. Is there anything that you'd like to plug or wrap up for the people and where they can find you on the social medias?
Sure. The podcast is called Bad with Money, and season 4 starts in March. And then, but you can listen to seasons 1 through 3. And then the book is called Bad with Money, The Imperfect Art of Getting Your Financial Shit Together. And that's out now. It came out January 1st. And I'm on Twitter at Gabby Dunn, although I'm more interesting, I think, on Instagram, which is at Gabby Road, which is a Beatles pun because I thought Instagram wasn't going to take off. And then some other girl got Gabby Dunn. So, look, it's fine.
I thought you were going to say you used to have the AOL screen name.
No, that's like what it was. And I was like, this will never be a thing. And then so I just made a name. And then now some other girl, she's lovely. I've communicated with her, but she has Gabby Dunn because that's also her name. And so I was like, yeah, you keep it.
Yeah, I think I'm the Marcus Garrett because it's something like a Marcus Garrett or whatever. Like my name, there's a much more successful Marcus Garrett. He's a basketball player at Kansas. Shout out to him.
There's also a murderer.
God.
I'll have to share that story another time.
Branding.
Yeah. So Marcus Garrett, do not Google me. I'm also out there.
So what do you think makes you more exciting on Instagram? Or, well, I mean, exciting, fun, et cetera.
I just like Instagram better because I sort of have stayed off Twitter for a while because Twitter is sad. And then if I look at Instagram, it's like, oh, my friend is at the beach. Look at my friend doing well. I love this. Oh, that person from The Bachelor, whatever. But then if it's like, if it's Instagram, you just open it and it's like, everything's on fire. And then you close it and you're like, I don't want to look at that.
Yeah, Twitter is definitely an acquired taste. It is a running chat room, however you feel about
chat rooms. And Instagram is just like, oh, look at this sunset. And I'm like, this is much better for me mental health wise.
So I guess that's as good as place with that awesome plug from Twitter, who obviously never plug us. Now we just lost lots of sponsorship. But thank you for coming on the show, Gabby.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I hope y'all enjoyed that vocal money memoir, bringing the bad with money out of the book and into the podcast and into your listening ears. I hope you had a lot of takeaways.
Yeah, and I really appreciated that she talked about some of the institutional and societal issues that affect people's financial and professional opportunities. And she didn't say financial institutions or institutional this or that, but she addressed them very clearly. And I think that that's super important and something that you'll hear a lot more about that on the podcast going forward. Listening to the conversation, I know I jumped in a bit here and there, but kind of hearing her thoughts on various things and understanding her experience in the comedic world, but also in the professional world as a writer was super dope. So Gabby, again, appreciate you coming onto the podcast. And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share with your network and hit us with those 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and say a few words about the show. Today's review of the week comes from Go Invest, G-O-E Invest. It reads, amazing show. You must listen. I've gone back over the last year and listened to every episode of the PNB show. Pure gold. I love the evolution and the chemistry between the hosts. As a Black professional, I am so happy to see y'all in the personal finance space. This has encouraged and inspired me on my journey to financial independence. Please keep up the good work. So Go Invest. Really appreciate those hashtag 5 stars.
I appreciate the 5 stars. And I also appreciate the loyalty to go back and listen to all 100 of those episodes, which I'm not even sure that's something I can claim. So you might have a new claim to fame there. And I do appreciate that.
Definitely.
For the rest of you, if you'd like to find us on social media, we're on Twitter and Instagram at Pay Balances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. Follow our individual accounts at The Marcus Garrett with 1 T on Twitter, 2 T's everywhere else on earth, and Rich is available at I Am Rich Jones.
I am.
And don't forget to join our email list by visiting paybal.co/email, where you receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more. And don't forget to rock the vote, the real vote, where every vote counts. And you can take for that what you mean, whatever you want to interpret it. And that is available at paybal.co/FedEx, case sensitive, paybal.co/FedEx.
With the capital F and that capital E. So we want to thank you for listening. And until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.